Hello and welcome. You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical-grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and theological insights. This is one of several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello. We're beginning the end of Jesus' life now in the study of Mark. We're going to be moving to the trials and the crucifixion. Very unpleasant thing for us to read, but something we need to hear and need to understand. Mark 14, beginning in verse 43. At that very moment, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up, and with him a crowd of men. I wonder why they brought so many men to capture Jesus. He'd been in the temple all the time teaching. I think subconsciously it shows their fear that they brought so many. What was the makeup of that crowd? I've got a graphic I want to show you that tries to describe that crowd. I think there were Roman soldiers there, as we learn from the Gospel of John. I think there were temple police that we learn from this account here. And also there were members of the Sanhedrin that we learn from Luke. It was a very large group of people. And they had come with torches, armed to the teeth, to arrest a Hebrew carpenter with 12 disciples. Now, notice if you would, and with swords and clubs. Now, the short swords were small swords worn in the belt. The assassins carried those. This is probably the Roman soldiers that carried these short swords. Now, when it says clubs, only the temple police carried clubs. And they got it from a passage in the Mosaic Law where it says that a Levite shouldn't shed blood. So they're just going to bludgeon you to death instead of stab you. And so the police, temple police carried clubs. Now, notice if you would, it says from the high priest, scribes, and elders. This, of course, is the designation of the Sanhedrin. The high priest is plural. It meant to be in the Old Testament a man for life and then his children. But during the Roman time, it had become a political plum to the highest bidder. The scribes, of course, were mostly Pharisees, and they were experts in the oral tradition especially, of the law. And then the elders were local Jewish leaders, powerful local people from the area. Then it says, and now his betrayer had given them a signal, saying, "The one that I kiss is he. Seize him and lead him away safely." Now, apparently this was for the Romans, because the temple police should have recognized him. As Jesus mentions down in verse 45, it's 49, I think. The temple police should have recognized him, so the Jewish soldiers would not have. Notice where it says, "whom I kiss." Now, that's always seemed a little gross to us. Matter of fact, even it mentions kiss with much affection down in verse 45. What we have here is the traditional greeting of a disciple to his rabbi. Many have tried to say by this that Judas had other motives. They usually say, well, he sold Jesus for such a small amount, 30 pieces of silver, not very much money. He kissed him with affection. He said, "don't hurt him, lead him away." I think we're reading too much into that. I don't know what's happening with Judas, but whatever's happening with Judas is somehow related to Judas being taken over by the evil one. Now, I want you to notice that when it mentions here, seize him and lead him away safely. What Judas wanted more than anything was them to take him away as soon as he showed him who he was. You bind him, you chain him, you handcuff him, and you take him away. Now notice in verse 45. So when he came, he went straight up to Jesus and said, "Rabbi," and with much affection kissed him. Strong term, isn't it? Now, there are several passages in your outline where Jesus adds a comment, and you can see those from your outline. And then they laid hands on him and arrested him, but one of the bystanders drew his sword. Now, John 18:10 tells it was Peter, drew his sword and struck the high priest's slave. Now, we also learn from John that it was Malchus. Now, this is Peter. Now, Peter was not a coward. There was a large group of armed men there, Romans, temple police. Peter apparently was the only one in the apostolic group who had a sword. Peter was ready to die right then. And he just chopped at the first thing he saw. He was trying to cut this man's head off. He wasn't after his ear, friend. He was after his whole head. Notice what happens. Jesus tells him to put it up. Now, in Luke 22:51, I want you to picture the scene. Here are these men with torches and clubs. They found this rabbi praying. They're going to arrest him. Judas has kissed him. They've grabbed him. Peter pulls out his sword, tries to kill someone, cuts off his ear. In the light of those torches, Jesus reached over, picked up the ear off the ground, put it back on the man's head like it had never been taken off. I don't think I'd arrested that boy that night. What a scene that must have been. And Jesus spoke and said to them, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were some robber?" Now, it's possible the interpretation means insurrectionist. We're just not sure. "Day after day I used to be with you in the temple teaching. You never laid hands on me." That seems to refer to the temple police. "But this is to fulfill scriptures." Now, what scripture are we talking about? Well, I think it goes with verse 50, not with verse 49. So I think it's Zechariah 13:7 we talked about. "And all the disciples forsook him and made their escape." Now, this is a bit of an overstatement. And it goes back to Zechariah, "But all the sheep are scattered," because John seems to stay with him. And the only way we have what happened is that John was even able to get in the high priest's home. And it was John who said, "I know Peter, let him in." Now, Peter did follow at a distance, but John was right with him the whole night, everywhere he went. And so it wasn't all the disciples exactly, but the vast majority. "And a young man was following him with only a linen sheet." Now, the linen sheet shows he was a pretty wealthy person, "thrown about his body, and they seized him, but he left his linen sheet behind and fled away naked." Now, tradition says this was John Mark, in whose home, tradition says, the Last Supper, the upper room. It may be true. We just don't know. It seems very unusual for this little account to be here. Why would it be in here? Because John Mark is the writer of the Gospel of Mark. And the recollection is from Peter, not from John Mark. So I think there is probably some good internal evidence this might be true, although it's just simply tradition. Now, notice where it mentions here. Let's see. Verse 53. "They took Jesus away to the high priest." Now, I have another graphic I want to show you that lists the order of the trials. And as you notice, it starts with Ananias, and that's in John. It's not recorded in the Synoptics. And then he goes before Caiaphas and the whole Sanhedrin. That's in Mark. And then we see him before the Sanhedrin again the next morning, then Pilate, then Herod, then finally Pilate again. And that seems to be the basic flow of these, although there is some disagreement among the Gospels exactly when they occurred. Notice what it mentions then. "And all the high priests, elders, and scribes," that's the Sanhedrin, "met there." Apparently they had already known they were going to try to arrest him, or just waiting several nights until they finally got him. "And Peter followed him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. He was sitting with the attendants and warming himself before the fire." Now, verse 54 breaks right into the context. It's kind of like, you know how sometimes these movies will show you what's happening simultaneously at another place? Well, that seems to be the literary technique here. We learn from other parts of the gospel that Peter couldn't even get in the courtyard until John said, "I know him, let him in." Now, the word for attendants here is interesting. It's a word that's used in verse 65 for the temple police. Basically, it's a word that came from the lower servants on the rowers on the lower deck of a trimarine, an ancient war vessel with three decks of rowers. Now, we come back in verse 55 to the trial inside. "And the high priest and the whole council," not all of them, I don't think Nicodemus was there, I don't think Joseph Arimathea was there, I think that little group was there, "were trying to get evidence against him." Now, the verb "were trying," "could find none," and "gave false testimony" are all imperfects. Now, that means this occurred over and over and over again. They'd bring a witness, he wouldn't agree with this witness. They'd start all over, try the witness again. Now, you want you to notice from the Old Testament, they took two witnesses to agree to convict someone. They couldn't find two witnesses to agree. Matter of fact, in the Old Testament, if a witness perjured himself, he had to take the penalty of the person he perjured, which meant this was death. So here are all these witnesses trying to say he did this, he did this. None of them could agree. They tried to put him to death. This really was a mock trial. Y'all see chapter 14:1. They've been planning this or much earlier than that. Although many men gave false testimony against him, their testimonies did not agree. Some took the witness stand and gave this false testimony against him. Quote, "We ourselves have heard him say, 'I will tear down this temple built by men's hands, and in 3 days I will build another without men's hands.'" Now, this is true. He did say that. But he used a different word for temple. They're using the word for temple that means the Holy of Holies, the central shrine. Jesus used the word for temple that meant the entire area. Now, what they did, they misunderstood what he was saying. Because several times he said that, but he said he's referring to the temple of his own body. Now, he was using the temple, how beautiful it was, but he was referring to the temple of his body about being destroyed in 3 days, rise it up. Of course, we know that in A.D. 70, drastically, literally fulfilled in the life of Israel when Jerusalem was sacked by Titus. Now, remember here where it mentions, let's see, verse 60. Then the high priest arose in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What about this testimony they've been giving against you?" But he kept silent and made no answer. Kind of fulfills the prophecy of Isaiah 53:7. Now, Jewish law is a very specific law, a fair law, and no one could ask a man to condemn himself or to bring witness against himself. That's exactly what the high priest is trying to do. It's just not going to work. So the high priest again questioned him. Now in Matthew 26:63, we learn he put him under oath. He said, "Swear to God you're going to tell the truth." And in these words he said, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now he was asking him point blank, because this is the central issue. Are you the one sent from God? Now, when it says the Son of the Blessed One, that's not a Jewish title for God, but a common title for the Messiah. And Jesus said, "Yes, I am." The very fact he said, "I am," is very important. It goes back to Exodus 3:14, which is a title for God. And boy, they recognized it real well. Then he says, "You will see the Son of Man." Now, of course, Son of Man is that unique term that Jesus used for himself. It originally meant just human being. But in Daniel 7:13, it came to mean human and divine. That's how Jesus is using it. Seated at the right hand of God. Now, that's Psalms 110:1, which is a powerful messianic psalm. And coming on the clouds of the sky. That's why Daniel 7:13 makes it deity, because only deity rides on the clouds. And here the Son of Man is. I think it's real important that the Jews understood exactly what Jesus was saying. And that's what they did. The high priest tore his clothes. That's a sign of blasphemy. Tore his outer garment. And what more evidence do we need now? Did you hear his own blasphemy? And blasphemy was a capital crime. Leviticus 24:14-16. What do you think? And they all condemned him as deserving to die. And some of them started to spit on him and blindfold him. Now apparently, this is related to Isaiah 11:3, which says that the Messiah will be able to tell people who by their smell and not by sight. And so apparently they're trying to do this. Now, this idea of spitting on someone is a sign of contempt. Numbers 12:14, Deuteronomy 25:9, Job 30:10, and Isaiah 56 are some passages. They begin to say to him, "Now play the prophet." Even the attendants took charge of him with slaps. I think Jesus is pretty beaten up right here. It's the first of many beatings that occurred. I think he got beat up here. I think he got beat up by Pilate's soldiers. I think he got beat up by Herod's soldiers. I think that prophecy that he was unrecognizable in Isaiah 53 is based on the beatings and the flogging that occurred before the crucifixion even. Now, notice it mentions here, verse 66, we're kind of going back in the courtyard. While Peter was down in the courtyard, one of the high priest's waiting girls, and we learned from John 18:17 that she was a doorkeeper, okay? Came up, and when she saw that Peter was warming himself, she looked at him. Apparently, the fire was burning, and Peter was getting his hands warm or something. The light of the fire was on Peter's face, and she said, "You look familiar. Weren't you one of his?" And listen to Peter. But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you mean." And he went out of the courtyard and was in the gateway of it. Now, apparently, he was trying to leave. Friends, he wanted out of that place, but the attendants at the gate recognized him. And the waiting girl saw him, began again to tell the bystanders, "This fellow is one of them," but he denied it again. And now we're in the last part of the denial. And again, a few minutes later, the bystanders begin to say to Peter, "You are surely one of them, for you are a Galilean too." Now, apparently, it was either his dialect. You know, I can sure tell someone from Mississippi or from New York. They can tell I'm from Texas. So apparently his Galilean dialect, they did something with certain guttural sounds that was very noticeable. Or maybe he was wearing traditional clothes of the Jews in Galilee, not the Jews in Judea. I don't know why, but they recognized him. And he commenced cursing and swearing. Now, cursing and swearing doesn't mean saying loose terms or sexual terms like we use today sometimes. What it means is making an oath that if I'm lying, may God strike me dead. That'd be an oath. Listen to what Peter's doing. He's bringing God's name into his lie. Now, notice if you would, and I do not know this man that you are talking about. He even leaves Jesus' name out. He's so afraid. At that moment, the second time, a cock crowed. Then Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you'll disown me three times." And then he remembered, and he burst into tears. Now, from Luke 23:61, he said at that moment they must have been transferring Jesus from one room to another. And Jesus turned and looked at Peter. Oh, it wiped him out. He left in tears. Now, we're picking up again in chapter 15. As soon as it was daylight. Now, what do we mean by this? Well, in Greek, it's immediately early, which means sometimes after midnight. Now, I think it's still dark because the Romans usually started their public court cases at dawn. And this had to happen before that because they're going to take him to Pilate early. So this is still dark. You say, well, why would they have two different ones? They're trying to give some kind of legitimacy to this night trial. You couldn't condemn a man and sentence him on the same day. So they're trying to say, we had two meetings. So they're meeting again as soon as it was daylight. The high priest held consultation. Now, this consultation means to make resolution. Apparently, they're going to try to decide on what formal charges to bring before Pilate. Now, they couldn't say a religious charge, so they're going to claim insurrection. Okay? With the elders and scribes, the Sanhedrin, the whole council, after binding Jesus. Now, isn't it funny? Here he is beat up. He's offered no resistance, but they're gonna bind him or tie him up every time they move him around. I think, again, a little of the subconscious fear they had of this man who reached down and put the high priest's ear back on, called Lazarus out of the tomb, spoke, and the waves quit rushing. And they think they can do it by tying his hands. Notice it says they took him away and turned him over to Pilate. Now, we don't know exactly where Pilate was. Pilate was the prefect of the Roman province of Syria, which included Jewish Judea. His normal headquarters was Caesarea by the sea. But during the Passover season, because of the great potential for riot, many times he would come to Jerusalem with many more troops. Now, usually when the high officer of the Roman army came to town, he stayed in the palace of the king. So he should have stayed in Herod's palace. They didn't get along too well before this. So he probably stayed in the fortress Antonio that overlooked the temple. We're not exactly sure where. Now, then Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He got right down to the insurrectionist charge, didn't he? In Luke 23:1-2, the charges are listed the Jews brought. And Jesus said, "You say that I am." Now, that is a Hebrew idiom of affirmation. What he's saying is, you're right, that's exactly what I'm claiming. And you might want to see Luke 22:70, for that is very clear. Now, let's see. And the high priest kept piling up accusations. Now, there's a real possibility that the Jews would not come inside because they would be ceremonially unclean for the Passover. Now, isn't it ironical these Jews have no problems in planning premeditated murder with false charges? But they're a little bit nervous about entering a Roman's house before the Passover. Golly, can you believe it? Murder's all right, but ceremonial cleanliness is not. It's hard to imagine, but it sounds just like religious people, doesn't it? Now, notice where it mentions the high priest kept piling up. I really think that Pilate took him inside and questioned him privately and then brought him back outside for a moment and then sent him to Herod. Now, when it says kept piling up, means they kept saying it over and over and over and over and over again. Now, just see how many charges they are making against you. But Jesus made no effort, no further answer at all. So Pilate was astonished. Now, at that time, the feast, and of course we're talking about the feast of the Passover, Pilate usually set a prisoner free whom the people requested. One or two things are happening here. This was a traditional thing that they did every year to try to make some kind of friends with the Jews. Now, that crowd that's waiting out front, it's very early in the morning. Maybe Barabbas' followers knew they were going to release somebody, and maybe they had gathered on their own. Or maybe the high priest had gathered the people who were at the trial that night. Or maybe a both, but I don't think many of the pilgrims were up this early and already in Jerusalem. They were still sleeping, most of them, out in the outlying areas. Simon of Cyrene is going to be walking into Jerusalem later. And that was probably what most of them were doing. Now, notice if you would here. Let's see. Lost my place. But Jesus made no effort at all to answer it. And at that time, the feast, Pilate usually set a prisoner free whom the people requested. Verse 7. There was in prison a man named Barabbas. Now, Barabbas, Bar-Abbas, means son of the father. Some manuscripts say Bar-Rabbas, which means son of the rabbis. And there's even a few manuscripts that say Jesus Barabbas. But they're pretty inferior, so I don't think that's really accurate. But here is a man who's a real insurrectionist. Notice that they're going to let a man go who is obviously guilty of treason and insurrection. And they're going to kill Jesus, who is obviously innocent of insurrection. Isn't that amazing? Well, the crowd among the revolutionaries who was in there, I can't read my own Bible, I got so many notes, who in their uprisings had committed murder. So a crowd of people came up and started request of the governor the usual favor. Verse 9. Then Pilate answered them by asking, what do you want me to do with the king of the Jews? Set him free? For he knew that the high priest, out of envy, had turned him over to them. Pilate, the embodiment of Roman justice, knew the motives of the high priest, but was unwilling to act. But the high priest stirred up the crowd to get him to set Barabbas free for them instead. Then Pilate said to them, what then do you want me to do with the man whom you call the king of the Jews? Now, in John 19:15, the Jews made this startling statement with the high priest there. We have no king but Caesar. Friends, you just can't imagine how much they hated Jesus to make a statement like that. They hated those Romans with a passion. They believed that God only was king. And here, to get Jesus crucified, they're willing to say something like that. I want to tell you another phrase they said that just gives me cold chill. They said, let his blood be on our head and our children's. And it is. Now, notice if you would, where it mentions then, and they shouted, crucify him. And Pilate again asked, why? What has he done wrong? But they shouted at the top of their voices, crucify him. What could they do? So they became a mob. And so Pilate wanted to satisfy the crowd. He set Barabbas free for them. But having Jesus flogged, he turned them over to be crucified. Now, y'all see Isaiah 53:3. I want to describe for you what flogging really is. A piece of wood about that long had nine pieces of straps of leather about 2 feet long attached to the end of it. On the end of every piece of leather was a bone or a rock or some kind of metal tied in. You took a man's clothes off, probably except his linen loincloth, and you bent him over all the way, tied his hands to a low pillar or stake or something where the man's almost standing up but in a U shape. And then you put a soldier on each side, and one would hit and the other would hit. And then one would hit. Friends, these pieces of these leather thongs would go clear around the body. They would knock out eyes, knock out teeth. They would rip the flesh off. It was not unusual for historical records to say that you could oftentimes see a man's internal organs through his back because all the flesh had been knocked off. Many people died under floggings. Now, everybody who was crucified was flogged. But I really believe that when you look at all the Gospels, that Pilate flogged Jesus first. Why? Because I think Pilate is really trying to gain sympathy for Jesus and let him go. And I guess he thought if Jesus was a bloody mess, maybe they'd have pity on him. So far, Jesus has been beaten, abused, spit on, and hit by the high priest and the attendants in the Sanhedrin. Then he was taken to Pilate and questioned, but taken to Herod, where Herod's soldiers made fun of him and apparently abused him physically. Then Pilate's soldiers beat him, flogged him, mocked him. Friends, I want to tell you, I don't know if you can imagine what kind of shape he was physically, but I bet he was almost unrecognizable. I imagine he would have died in a few days from those wounds, much less being crucified. And we're going to leave this right now until next lesson. I hope that you'll stop for a minute, close your eyes, and try to picture yourself being there. I want you to think about following Jesus to the Garden of Gethsemane, watching him fall on the ground in agony, great drops of blood, and pray the same prayer three times that if possible this might pass from him. I want you to see him as they come to arrest him. And in the flickering light of the torches, he puts the high priest's servant's ear back on. I want you to see him as John stays with him, but Peter follows at a great distance. And they take him to these different high priests and try to get him to say what they want him to say so they can kill him. And then beat him up and spit on him, blindfold him. I want you to see him before Pilate as he really tries to speak to Pilate's heart. I think Jesus really tried to get to Pilate, not to save himself, but to redeem Pilate. The same way he tried at the last minute to shock Judas into accepting him and trusting him. Then I think we can see him as he's so badly abused and mocked. Friends, this is the Son of God who left the riches of heaven to become poor, to take our sin on himself, pay the price for our crimes, that by his righteousness we might be healed and whole. That's who we're talking about. I want you to think of the unfairness and the severity of this. Some of the most zealous, ugly people I've ever met have been religious people. It almost seems like in the name of God, they'll do anything. It's like the end justifies the means. We see him here like that for you, for me. God bless you. I'll see you again next week.